Welcome to ITE 1, Semester 2, Module 8, Part 2. This is a lecture on networking technologies. And first, we are going to do a little bit of review from what we did last week. Not too much, because we have a lot to cover this week. First of all, does anyone have any outstanding questions before I start? Okay. Well, we'll take that as a no. Now, one other thing before I start, I would like to recommend the supplementary lecture that we did last week. It was Friday, Thursday night for people who were in America. Elise, Jackie, and I, and Mark actually went and reviewed some of the concepts in lecture one. And we did some hands-on exercises, which you can follow along with and participate with at your convenience. And it was a very good lecture. And Jackie McBride actually made her teaching debut, and it was all really good. So you should probably have a listen to that if you're unclear about anything in the first lecture. Now on to our review. A computer data network is a collection of hosts connected by networking devices. So, a host is any device that sends and receives information on a network. The peripherals are devices that are connected to hosts. Some devices can serve as either hosts or peripherals. For example, a printer connected to your laptop, which is on a network, is acting as a peripheral. But if the printer was connected directly to a network device such as a hub, it would be a host. Does it have an IP address? What type of devices can connect to networks, you guys?
Printers?
Yeah.
Wireless gaming consoles?
Sure.
Computers, of course.
Absolutely. All good answers. Those would all be, except the printer sometimes, usually they would be hosts. They have IP addresses. And, yep, so those are all sorts of devices that can connect to the internet or the network. Networks can provide printing services, file sharing. They can provide, of course, a way out to the internet. The benefits of networking, or some of them, are that you can have less licenses for applications if you have network applications. You don't have to have as many devices. Imagine an office building, as I said, where each desk had a printer on it. Not only would you be taking up lots of desk space, but you'd have lots of ink and toner to buy, lots of paper to buy, and you'd have to buy and maintain all of those printers. It'd be much better if you only had one or two network printers instead of 100 people with printers on their desks. Any questions on that really basic stuff?
I'm sure there's one in my head somewhere, but it's not coming to me right now, so I'll get back to you on that maybe after the lecture.
No problems. Okay. We're going to quickly review, because it is very important, the difference between LAN, WAN, and WLAN technologies. So a LAN, LAN, is a local area network. Now, as I said last week, this can be over many buildings. It used to be that it would only be in like one office building, but it could stretch a whole campus or a whole group of office buildings. And what makes it a LAN is not that it is necessarily really close together, but that it is maintained by one group or one administrator, and you're going to get the same service anywhere that you go in that area. A wide area network, WAN, can span, like, there are some that will span across entire states, or I believe even some that will span across countries. Places like AT&T have WANs to connect their networks together. The internet is one a very good example of a WAN. In fact, it's the biggest WAN. Now, sounds similar, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and for anyone's information who may be listening to this, the internet was originally a military application.
That's actually covered in your notes, Mark. Military development, 1963, but thanks for that.
Okay, and in the category of things that sound similar but are definitely not, we have the WLAN. A WAN is very different from a WLAN. A WLAN is a wireless local area network. That would be like your home router that is wireless. And you can, you don't have to be connected to your router to get the internet. So that is a WLAN. Now, can anyone name any advantages of having a peer-to-peer network versus a client-server network?
So, for the majority, maintained by can be maintained by one individual.
No, that's the other way around. That would be a client-server model. We're looking for advantages of peer-to-peer networks. A peer-to-peer network is where each computer manages its own shared permissions. And an advantage to this is that you do not have to maintain any kind of server, and you don't have the costs associated with the server, including someone to run it.
Would that be an advantage in a very small organization or in a home situation?
Absolutely. You don't have to pay for somebody to run your server, and you get to decide what you're sharing on each computer.
Anecdote time. There was actually a situation where there's a little mining company that's got about 4 to 6 people in it that a friend of mine works for, and my friend said to him, well, I'll do your network administration correctly for you, and it'll cost you $60 an hour. And the guy sort of went, $60 an hour is fairly expensive, I'll have to think about that. And this guy turned to him and said, well, you can either get me at $60 an hour and I'll do the job properly, or you can get any idiot out of the paper at whatever they happen to charge, and your mileage may vary. And apparently the look on this guy's face said very clearly that this is what this guy had been doing, and that's why his IT infrastructure was in such a mess, because he'd been getting whoever quoted at the lowest bidder, and the quality of the work varied proportionally. So good network admins cost lots of money, and if you want somebody to be on call, especially on unusual hours and stuff, you'll have to pay for that privilege. So, yes, paying a network administrator can be quite expensive. Usually, if you're employing one full-time, you're looking at $30,000 a year and up for a cheap one.
And if you'd like to make that kind of money and think you're smart enough, CCNA might be the course for you.
Or if you complete the IT Essentials course, you can branch out into the A+ certification, which has a network subarm. So submit all of your worksheets and labs today. Finish your course and you could be on the big bickies. Cavi, it's not just an occupying pastime. Okay, I'm done.
I like bickies.
Me too. Okay, so now that we've described a peer-to-peer network, does anyone have any idea what advantages to having a client-server model might be?
It'd be a definite advantage in a big organization.
Why would it be? Area of administration.
Yeah.
Backups.
Why would it be an advantage in a big
organization? Well, in
security.
A big organization, that's part of it, security. But in a big organization, if you didn't have somebody to run your administration, you'd be in a hell of a mess, I wouldn't mind betting.
And you'd have no one to blame if things went wrong.
Exactly. Imagine if everybody in, let's say, a school had to manage everything they shared, and each person had to manage their own computer and what they shared and had to set up their own file and printing stuff. That would be pretty crazy, especially because some of the people in schools are not network administrators. They're teachers, and they, while they might know how to run a word processor, they may not know how to do the file sharing, because that's not their job. So that's why we have servers.
Okay, here's an extract from a typical conversation in a peer-to-peer network. Jill, do you happen to know where the expenses spreadsheet is?
It's called expenses.xls, and, I think it's on Bob's computer. Oh, no, it's on Jill's computer. Oh, no, you want the one from Paul's computer? Or did Paul back that up? No, it must be on Bill's computer.
So, as you can see, centralized management is certainly an advantage.
Then who writes whatever changes and you lose the stuff in the middle? And, yeah, we need to centralize these things.
I'm getting this message that says my spreadsheet's already open, so how do I get it open?
Yeah, that's a similar sort of problem.
Yeah. Believe it or not, we've all been in this situation in our older days. Don't you worry about that.
Oh, yeah, I've been in it on my home network.
Just a very quick question. Do you get the paid version of Windows Secrets, Elise?
No, I should. But I should sign up for that.
Let me sort something out for you. There's an article called The Pros and Cons of Switching to Windows 7. I will mutt bounce it to you, and that will answer any of your questions.
Thank you.
The other major advantage, as Jenny was saying, was security. Imagine everybody having to deal with their own files. What if one of the teachers, in their infinite wisdom, somehow, and you can do this because I've done it and I meant to do it, gave read and write access to their My Documents folder on a peer-to-peer network. And some student came up to another computer in the lab and deleted every single lesson plan the teacher had. Now, how would that be? So that's why we have servers, so that the administrators can decide what's best for you in that case, and they know that you should not have that students should not have read-write access to the lesson plans folder.
Yes, I'm from the IT crowd, and I'm here to help.
Yep.
For anybody who hasn't seen the IT crowd, it's a good show. Watch that British comedy. In all seriousness, the other thing is that, as previously discussed, if you're doing non-centralized backups, it'll be the day that you've forgotten to run the backup on your workstation that you'll delete something really, really important. And if the data is your responsibility, you are in serious trouble, and there's nothing anybody can do to help you except guide you towards a large glass of alcohol for you to drown your sorrows and then try and put things back together in a day or three. Whereas the network administrator takes some advantage of the backup responsibility.
And you know what? In many workplaces, backups are not as important to one person as they might be to another person, so somebody may not do their backups because they don't think it's that important.
That's right. Chris said to this guy, just because we're continuing the story, he goes, okay, so the first thing we'll do is we'll get your backup system up and running and we'll get those backups happening. And the guy said, and I quote, oh, no, look, backups aren't really that important. What I really need you to do is, and he inserted another task, so yeah, don't worry about the backup system too much. And this is with a mining company.
All right, we're going to very, very quickly go over IP addresses one more time here. And if you have any questions, feel free to ask, but do go over that supplemental lecture. And this is a very brief overview here. So an IP address is a logical address. It's 32 bits long. It's expressed by dotted decimal notation, which is four groups of numbers separated by dots. Each group of numbers is 8 bits long. The MAC address has 48 bits.
I was going to say that the number range is 0 to 255. That's important.
It is. The MAC address is 48 bits long. This is expressed as six groups of two hexadecimal characters each. And what I'd like to point out is a MAC address is like your fingerprint. It doesn't change. You're born with it. That is your physical identity. The IP address is like your postal address or phone number. That can change wherever you are. At home, you have one address. At work, you have another address. And when you go out to a restaurant, you have yet another address. People cannot find you at home when you're at work. So if they try to contact you there, they'll not be able to. But people can always identify you, or most of the time, identify you by your fingerprints. Does that make any sense?
I was just going to mention that a MAC address is burned in to a network card or a networking device, so the MAC address is usually burned in at the factory. MAC addresses can, in certain circumstances, be changed, but we don't cover it in this course, that's CCNA3, but a MAC address is actually burnt into your card and it's actually printed on a sticker that's on the back of your network card, generally speaking. So be aware of that, that each networking card or networking device that has a MAC address, it's bound to that card. Also, MAC addresses are only relevant on the local network on which they exist, so on your local area network, you do not use MAC addresses over a wide area network. They are a local concept, so just be aware of that.
I was just going to get into that. A MAC address is used to deliver frames on the local area network, while an IP address is used to transmit frames outside the LAN. A frame is a data packet along with address information added to the beginning and end of the packet before transmission over the network. Once a frame is delivered to the destination LAN, the MAC address is used to deliver the frame to the end host on the LAN. So if you have want any more help with those concepts, do read your notes and listen to the supplemental lecture. Unless you have any questions right now, I'll be happy to answer them for you. Okay. We're going to go over a little bit about the DHCP server. On a small network, a network administrator can assign IP addresses, subnet masks, and default gateways automatically, but...
Manually.
That's exactly what I mean. But they might forget, as the network gets bigger, which ones they've already assigned, or they might not want to do it because there are too many computers. Fortunately, the DHCP server comes to the rescue. Does anyone remember what DHCP stands for?
Dynamic Host Control Protocol.
Absolutely. This server actually assigns many network details, such as your IP address, your subnet mask, and your default gateway, as well as DNS servers, probably, and many other things can be assigned by a DHCP server. Now, I think this is on the test. A MAC address is not assigned by the DHCP server. It is always with your computer. It's not assigned by the DHCP server. I'm pretty sure that one is in your test.
Yeah, there's actually a question. Which of the following three can be assigned by a DHCP server? And MAC address is not one of them, people. So if you want easy marks, MAC address is not one of them. For Jenny's benefit, bookmark 24 inserted.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, then it's 37. If your computer has not been assigned an automatic a static IP address and a DHCP server is not available for some reason, Windows will assign an automatic private IP address, or a PIPA, APIPA. If your computer is assigned an IP address in the range of 169.254.0.0 to 169.254.0.0, .255.255, your computer will only be able to communicate with other computers in the same range and connected to the same network. You cannot get out on the internet when you have an APIPA. Now, try to remember that range. Again, it is 169.254.0.0 to 165.255.255.255. That may be in your final exam.
No, it's not, and it was 169.254.255.255.
That's what I said.
The other thing to remember is that if you are reading ipconfig output, it will say auto configuration address. Now, that means that a PIPA is in action. So if it says IP address, and it gives an IP address, and it's been handed out by a DHCP server, but if it says auto configuration address, then that's been handed out by a PIPA. So that's capital screaming italics. Okay, so be aware of that if you're looking at your IP address configuration screen. Just a point from one of our students. We got a message saying that if you want to find out what your IP address is, you can open a web browser and go to www.ipchicken.com or www.whatismyip.com is another one. And there's a third one which we'll tell the local students about after lecture.
Yeah, if you want something really kind of cute and sort of inappropriate way to find out your IP address, kind of funny, message me and I'll tell you about it after class.
So what would be the purpose of assigning a PIPA?
Well, it could be useful in a class laboratory environment where you want to prevent access outside of your network.
It's also useful if you have, say, four computers connected to a switch and they all need to communicate with each other, but they don't need to communicate with anything else. So if you have no DHCP server at all, you plug the cables into the switch and those four computers, if you have the default Windows settings of workgroup as your workgroup and you have different computer names, Bill, Bob, Sam and Harry will all be able to see each other across the switch with no user intervention whatsoever. And that's what we call zero configuration networking, which is what a PIP is all about. In other words, it should just work out of the box with the user touching nothing.
So it's really just a like putting an internet bar on your computers, is that right? Is that the way, have I understood it right?
Wow.
No, basically,
no.
If a DHCP server is unavailable, two things can happen. I'll just wait for Grace's, yeah, we go, Grace's microphone's off there. If you have a DHCP server that's unavailable and you have no PIPA, you'll get assigned an IP address of 0.0.0.0, which means you'll talk to no one. If you get assigned an PIPA address, and there are other machines that have also been assigned an PIPA address, the machines on the local network will be able to communicate with TCP/IP inside the network that they're on, but they won't be able to talk to anything else. So it's not like putting an internet bar on. In fact, there are feasible ways of making a PIPA route stuff outside the network. But the fact is that you will get an IP address and you can use TCP/IP and you can share files and printers over a local network in the case of when a DHCP server is not present. It's just to handle the case where your DHCP server or your static configuration is not set up. It's a fallback.
It means you can still keep working and collaborating within your network even though you don't have a DHCP address and cannot get to the internet. Your computer will continually request an IP address from a DHCP server for your until it actually comes back online or somebody fixes up your static IP.
Isn't it kind of a commonplace thing for corporations to do stuff like that?
A PIPA, no. Restrict internet access, yes. Don't confuse the two things. They are completely different things. Most organizations do have DHCP servers or very strict network configuration that they would put on the PCs. So, yeah.
A PIPA is a fallback thing. Okay, so we are on to bandwidth, and I think we talked a little bit about this last week. Bandwidth is the amount of data that can be transferred over a certain period of time. It's expressed in bits per second, that is capital K, lowercase b, lowercase p, lowercase s. It can also be expressed in megabits per second. A bit is the smallest amount of data possible. There are 8 bits in a byte, so your internet speed is not tracked in megabytes per second. It's megabits per second, so you're not going to get the speed you would at megabytes per second. That would be just crazy.
Has anybody ever noticed that when watching the download speed indicator on Internet Explorer, which we've all done, haven't we, that it will say 54 kilobytes per second or 55.6 kilobytes per second, which bears no relationship to the fact that your internet speed is 512 kilobits per second? Well, it does, but the speeds will actually vary significantly from what your internet line speed is quoted at in bandwidth terms. And that's because there's packet overhead and all sorts of things that we don't go into there. But suffice it to say that the internet speed guide is only a guide. and it will give you an approximation of how fast your internet goes in whatever unit you choose to express it in, but us technical types measure bandwidth in bits per second.
When data is sent over the computer network, it is broken up into small units called packets. Each packet contains headers. A header is information added to each packet that contains the source and destination of the packet, either or both source and destination MAC addresses and or source and destination IP addresses. A header also contains information that describes how to put all the packets back together again at the destination, because if you don't put them back together, you're not going to get that new cool Britney Spears song that you really never wanted to hear anyway. As you know, we have many rules for written and verbal communication. If I asked a question, you wouldn't know necessarily if I asked a question if I said, okay guys, so what, how many bits are in an IP address? You want to make your voice actually go up. So guys, how many bytes in an IP address? Can anyone tell me? Something like that.
So,
no.
So
okay, that's a good question, see? Yeah. So the internet works the same way. Internet protocols are sets of rules governing communications within and between computers on a network. Kind of like the post office. You've got to have the right information on an envelope to send a letter. You have to have the right source and destination information to send a packet. One of the biggest jobs of protocols is to deal with timing. If a host sends a request and does not receive a response, the host is not going to wait forever because it's going to usually assume the packet is lost. For example, a 404 error. Imagine if your internet browser just waited and waited and waited and never told you that your server was timed out so you could get on with your life.
Technically speaking, 404 is document not found, and that is actually a reply sent by the web server. There is actually a different code for a timeout, but those actual things are sent back by the web server. It's the Internet Explorer cannot display this page message, which is your timeout.
That's
message.
What I wanted. Other functions of protocols are identifying errors, compressing the data, deciding how data is to be sent, addressing data, deciding how to announce sent and received data. Some protocols you may be familiar with are HTTP, POP3, SMTP, and FTP.
Sorry, guys.
No problem.
I don't care if I get into trouble. It's TPGIP.
That's okay.
It happens.
Tell me about it.
My meowie comment of the day is you get what you pay for.
Oh, yes. And they might be getting a letter from the Ombudsman, so there.
Yeah. Sounds like my, one of my lovely, wonderful cable companies back in the States. Well, we're going to talk about... God. Stop that. No one was yawning.
Oh, I thought you were yawning, sorry.
Now you are.
Yeah, stop that.
Stop that, Jenny. we're going to talk about a protocol we talked a little bit about last week, but we're going to go into a little more detail about how it's used. And it's a protocol that you may not be as familiar with called ICMP, and that stands for Internet Control Messaging Protocol. It's used by devices on a network to send control and error messages to computers and servers. Ping Packet Internet Groper is a common use for the ICMP protocol. Data in the form of a packet arrives at a router, which router, of course, is a networking device that forwards packets across networks, which we will talk about shortly. If the router does not know where to send the packet, the router deletes it. The router then sends an ICMP message back to the sending computer, informing it that the data was deleted. So, nope, we don't know where to send this. We got rid of it. Sorry, try again.
Just a point here, the actual technical term is drops it. You are correct, it is deleted, but a router actually drops packets, which is where it just basically throws them away. So if you hear of dropped packets, they're not actually deleted, because that would infer that the router was actually scrubbing them out. The router just pretends it didn't see them. It sticks its fingers in its router ears and goes, la, 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 can't hear you. And it just drops the packet.
Yes.
No, it's a female thing, because you get multiple streams of information. It can't multitask and it overloads.
Well said, Jenny. She just said it's a much.
No, the female thing's coming up. That is the male thing. It just pretends it didn't hear it. It's selective hearing, and that's the male thing. We're going to talk about the female thing that the router does in just a second. So for the females, when a router becomes very busy, it may send a different IMCP message to the computer, indicating that it should slow down because there's too much congestion on the network. Slow down, I'm not getting all of your packets, and I need more time to process it. There's your female for you. Mm-hmm. Any questions on the IMCP? ICMP protocol?
Is it actually recoverable? I mean, if...
Do what?
For whatever...
Do what?
Is it actually recoverable? It depends on the type of message that's returned. If it says network unreachable, you can always try the request again. If it says host unreachable, you can try it again. If it says no route to host, you can try it again. It depends on which, if it's saying congested, then certainly you can try sending the packets later. This is the method by which the error messages get back to the sending host. Otherwise, you wouldn't know what had gone wrong.
And you're not going to see a lot of this, and your protocols will actually handle some of the packet loss and decide what to do with your with the information from there.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to talk about network devices. Does anyone know what a hub is?
Yep.
Go ahead.
Something where you can put all your USB devices in. 4 and 7, I think I've noticed.
That is a hub, but we're more talking about network hubs in this case.
However, the USB hub does do what a network hub does, so I'll give a marks for that. It's just USB hubs and network hubs. A USB hub is to USB what a networking hub is to networks. In other words, it allows you to concentrate more than one device onto a single connection, so you can hook a whole lot of computers into a hub. You get half of the cyber lollipop, yeah.
Yeah.
So you are partially correct. They are a similar concept.
A hub you can think of as a multi-port repeater. You send out a packet, and the hub broadcasts the packet to all of the other devices on it. And all of the devices that the packet is not for discard it, and the one that the packet is for keeps it and processes the packet.
Hubs are rare in 2009.
Yeah. They're superseded by switches. Can anyone tell me what a switch is?
A network switch.
Network switch, yeah. Not a light switch.
When I think of a switch of any kind, it's a way to switch from one network to another?
No, that's a bridge.
No, it's not.
Or a router.
Yeah, a router. I'll go with a router for network to network.
Switches are smart. So, switch smart. You can remember it like that. The switch actually takes the data and looks at the MAC address of the packet, and will send the packet out to the only the computer that it's meant for. So it keeps collisions down. And that's why they've been replaced by, or that's why hubs have been replaced by the switches, because the networks are much less congested, and it only goes out to the one host that, or the host that it needs to go to.
Unless, of course, it's a broadcast packet, whereupon it goes out to all of the hosts. It's a point to say that broadcast packets will be sent to
absolutely
all hosts on the switch.
So the switch is like the postman.
Yep. Now your router, go ahead. A router can forward packets between different networks, for example, over the internet. A bridge can connect two network segments together. Most routers have bridges in them. And that leads us to our ISRs, integrated service routers. These are devices, and you know what? Most of your home routers are internet server integrated service routers. They will usually have in them a router, a switch, and possibly a wireless access point, as well as a firewall. And that's one of the things that you will get in your test. So it's a switch, a router, a firewall, possibly a wireless access point. Is yep.
Bookmark 38 inserted.
That's what most of you guys have at your homes right now, is an ISR. Any questions on network devices? Wow, who'd have thought? Oh, that's even better. All right, with that, we're going to move on to the wonderful world of cables. There are many different types of cables we can use to connect our networks. The most common type is the twisted pair. It's a type of copper cabling that is used for telephone communication and most Ethernet networks. A pair of wires forms a circuit that can transmit data. The pair is twisted to provide protection against crosstalk, which is the noise generated by adjacent pairs of wires in the cable.
Adjacent meaning next to each other, in case you didn't
right
swallow a dictionary this morning.
Pairs of copper wires are encased in color-coded plastic insulation and twisted together. An outer jacket protects the bundles of twisted pairs. There are two basic types of twisted pair cables. We have our unshielded twisted pairs, that is UTP for short, and these are cables that have two or four pairs of wires. This type of cable relies on only the cancellation effect provided by the twists. There's no extra shielding to prevent crosstalk. So you will have some degradation as opposed to your shielded twisted pair cables. It's the most commonly used cabling in networks. And it has a range of 320 feet, or 328 feet, that is, and 100 meters. That's on your test. The range is 100 meters for unshielded twisted pair cabling. The other type of networking cable, which is not nearly as common, is shielded twisted pair cabling. Each pair of wires is wrapped in metallic foil to better shield the wire from noise. The four pairs of wires are then wrapped in an overlapping metallic braid or foil, and this reduces electrical noise from within the cable. It also reduces EMI and RFI from outside the cable. And the STB does provide more shielding, but it's much more expensive, and it's not nearly as flexible because it's thicker, and it has all of that shielding inside of it. Any questions on either of those? Okay, now we'll talk about the category ratings of unshielded twisted pair cabling. It comes in several categories, which are based on the number of wires in the cable and the number of twists in the wires. We have category 3, wiring, which is used for telephone systems and for some Ethernet LAN at 10 megabits per second. I've never actually seen category 3 cable used in an Ethernet network, so I think it's pretty rare.
It is, but back in my day, I saw some.
Back in 1993, 94, category 3 was quite common. And the network speeds we had were 10 megabits. And yes, there are fewer twists per meter, and it's certainly not recommended for modern installations. You would want Category 5 or better. And I'll just wait for Grace to replug her headphones back in. You've knocked your headphones out.
I'm not going to do it. And we're back. Sorry about that. Category 3 has 4 pairs of wires. We have Category 5 and Category 5E. Now, these are the ones you guys are really concerned about, because this is what's used in most modern networks. They also have 4 pairs of wires with a transmission rate of 100 megabits per second. Cat5E can be used in gigabit Ethernet connections, but technically you really should be using Category 6, which we'll talk about in a minute. As I said, they're the most common network types used. And Category 5E has more twists per foot than Category 5 wiring, and the extra twists further protect from interference outside of the cable.
The higher the rating, does that mean the better the performance?
Yeah. We've got Category 6, which has more twists per foot again, and some of the Category 6 cables are even have plastic dividers to separate the pairs of wires, which prevents interference.
Isn't that all Category
6? No, it says some.
Oh.
And they are good for gigabit Ethernet, which is 1,000 megabits per second. Again, you can use Cat5e if you really want to, but not recommended, and probably you wouldn't say that in the test because it doesn't say that here.
So just to make sure that I'm understanding here, so again, the higher the rating, the more megabits?
Yep, and the better quality of cable. The more twists per foot, and yeah.
Generally the more expensive, slightly speaking.
Absolutely.
Good, fast, cheap, pick two.
Good, fast, cheap, pick two.
Yeah, I was just going to say, the higher the quality, the more expensive, and yeah.
Absolutely. And Cat 6 cables, if they've got those plastic dividers, are a little less flexible than your Cat 5 and Cat 5e cables. Just keep that in mind. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, is there some specific reason for the stiffer configuration? Is it meant for some
It protects it more. If you've got a plastic divider, it's going to be stiffer, and that protects from the crosstalk and the interference.
Oh, okay.
Any other questions on categories or unshielded twisted pair cables in general?
Nope.
Okay, coaxial cable is copper cord cable surrounded by heavy shielding. Coaxial cable is used to connect computers in a network. I've never seen this either, so it's not very common. There are several types of coaxial cables. Now, the most you will probably ever see coaxial cable is between the wall and your router if you have a cable connection.
careful, however, because the impedance of the one that runs from your cable router to your wall is 75 ohms, whereas the stuff you need to use for your cheaper net connection is 50 ohms. Don't mix the two. Bad things, TM, happen. Yes, ham radio users use a lot of coax, and that is RG58, I think, which is 50 ohms.
It is. It was always the 50-ohm stuff. There was one ending in a U too, wasn't there?
59U.
And I'm going to go over the different types of coax cable and what it's used for. We have ThickNet or 10 base 5. This coax cable was used in networks operating at 10 megabits per second. So not so much used. It had a max... No. Maximum length of 500 meters, though. We had ThinNet, which was 10 base 2, a coax cable that was used in networks operating at 10 megabits per second with a maximum length of 185 meters. This was used because it was more flexible. We have RG59. This is most commonly used for cable television in the U.S. So that's what you're going to feel between your cable and your router. We've got RG6, higher quality cable than RG59, with more bandwidth and less susceptibility to interference. Any questions on coaxial cables?
Yeah, I've actually got a question on the length of the cable. If you get... I'm just trying to figure out how to say it. So the last one you were talking about, which was 100 and how many meters?
185. It really isn't used very much anymore.
Okay. So when you get beyond that length, does it mean the performance goes down? Or?
Yep, you get signal degradation.
In easy speak, the network becomes less reliable. Data transfer can become slower. You can experience higher packet loss. Things become dicey and dodgy. So
don't do it. And that's for any kind of cabling. And also wireless. If you get outside the recommended range, that's what's going to happen to your network. Absolutely. If you've ever walked outside and taken your laptop away from your house and watched the wireless signal go down, down, down until there's none, you'll know about the signal degradation and how dicey things can get. If you haven't done it,
I was just going to say, I haven't done it with a computer, but I have done it. I had a cordless phone, and the signal, when I went from the further from the base down to the mailbox and my mom's, at one point it dropped the call. There was no signal strong enough to pick it up.
Yep, and that's exactly what will happen with a cable or a wireless connection. So if you haven't for some reason done it with either a portable phone or a laptop computer, you might want to try it and see what the results are, and you'll get a very good demonstration of the loss of signal quality.
Interestingly enough, one of the biggest complaints about Microsoft's Zero Configuration utility is that it only gives signals in terms of very low, low, poor, good,
poor.
And excellent.
Very good, excellent.
Whereas a network technician probably wants a DBM reading, which would make more sense than kind of okay, pretty cruddy, absolutely hopeless, or you're rocking. So, you know, it's a bit of a subjective measure.
That'd be pretty awesome.
That'd be awesome. Your connection is awesome.
Awesome. It's awesome.
Awesome.
Okay. Okay. After that loveliness, we're going to go on to fiber optic cable. A fiber optical cable is a glass or plastic conductor that transmits information using light. Because it transmits using light, it's not going to be susceptible to electromagnetic interference or crosstalk, because it's light. It's not electricity. So this means that the fiber optic cable can has better signal for longer. All signals are converted to light pulses that enter the cable, and then they get converted back into electrical signals at the other end. The fiber optic, this means that the fiber optic cable can deliver signals that are clearer for longer distances, and it has greater bandwidth than cable or copper cable. Fiber optic cables can reach distances up to several miles or kilometers before signals need to be regenerated. So much farther than your 100 meters. This is kilometers or miles. It's a long way. So a lot of the networks that you have that are long distances are parts of them are fiber optic. A fiber optic cable is usually more expensive to use than copper cabling, and the connectors are more costly and harder to assemble. We have common connectors for fiber optic networks, and they are SC, ST, and LC. The three types of fiber connectors are half duplex, which means data can flow in only one direction. See last week's lecture. Does anyone need a review on the simplex, half-duplex, full-duplex?
I have a question.
Is
there any difference in the performance, any difference between the glass and plastic?
That depends on your application. I think the glass tends to be more expensive, and you tend to use glass in single-mode fiber, which uses lasers for longer distance, and you tend to use plastic over shorter distances in multi-mode installations.
Oh, yeah.
It's a better conductor of light, generally speaking, yeah.
So in a fiber optic connection, two cables are needed, one to go one way and one to go the other way so that data can flow in both directions.
Actually, two fibers are needed, and they're often encased in the same outer jacket, so two fibers, one cable. Has anybody ever seen optical fiber? It's about, it's really thin. It's probably about as thick as 8-pound fishing line, maybe a bit thicker.
Oh.
I've seen how it was made. Gotta love that Science Channel and how it's made.
That's kind of a cool show.
You can also look stuff up on howstuffworks.com if you can navigate the advertising, and it'll show you how optical fiber is made. Also, if you're not rich enough to have cable television, or you don't happen to have it, because in Australia you don't want to pay for Foxtel, you can also, yeah, basically it's fairly thin, it's fairly flexible. In fact, the best way to see optical fiber is to go down to one of those everything you can buy for in dollars sorts of shops, and you'll often see these colourful lamps that have lots of fibre optic cables in them that diffuse the light out in different colours and stuff, sort of like a lava lamp or whatever.
Yeah, they're the weird quilly things.
Go Spencer's, you'll find a whole wall full of them.
Yeah.
Basically a costume jewellery type store, and they get clothing and they get all these Halloween thingies and all these different things to have parties and stuff.
You can find all sorts of crap at Spencer's. Anyway, we're going to go over the two types of fiber optic cables. We have multi-mode. This has a thicker core than the single-mode cable. It's easier to make, so that means that it is less expensive to install. It has simpler light sources, LEDs, and it works well over distances of a few kilometers or less. You've got your single mode cable. This has a very thin core. It's harder to make and uses lasers as a light source, which means it can travel much farther, dozens of kilometers, with ease.
I believe the specs, and they're expanding this all the time, depending on the network standards, you're looking at 40 kilometres between repeater stations for single-mode fibre. Although that has probably gone up since I looked up my specs, so check up Wikipedia. And if you're using JAWS 11, you can use the Research It feature to look that up straight away by going into Wikipedia and keying in single-mode fibre or whatever.
Okay, do we need a review on LAN architectures, or are we good? LAN architectures? Do you want a review or no? Okay.
No, there are MP3s up on the site. You are encouraged to download part one of the lecture and rerun it again.
And they're in the notes, and they're explained very clearly in the notes. I will tell you that a physical topology and a logical topology can be quite different. So you can have a physical star topology, but the network could be a token ring or bus logical topology. So there you go. And I am scrolling. I will talk quickly about the mesh topology. This is the most secure, most reliable topology because every single host is connected to every single other host. So if a connection to one fails, it's still connected to everything else.
Often used in nuclear power stations and those sorts of exciting places that need that sort of high reliability.
We are going to talk about Ethernet now. The Ethernet architecture is based on, IEEE 802.3 standard. The IO, the standard specifies that a network use the carrier sense multiple access with collision detection, CSMA slash CD access control method, and the host access the network using a first-come, first-serve broadcast topology method to transmit data. So what this means is the network sends a message, and they try to detect when, if there are collisions, because if there are collisions, then the packets can become corrupted. If there's a collision, both packets are discarded. The host wait a few seconds and try to send again.
A few microseconds.
Well, microseconds, yes. Ethernet uses a logical bus technology, that's in the test, and either a bus or star physical topology. As networks expand, most Ethernet networks are implemented using an extended star hierarchical topology, and standard transfer rates of Ethernet are 10 megabits per second, 100 megabits per second, and now 1,000 megabits per second, also called gigabit Ethernet.
Ah, 10 gigabit copper now exists too. You looked that up on Wikipedia too.
That's pretty cool.
Only good for distances of up to 10 to 20 meters though.
Oh, not so cool. We're going to talk a little bit about the token rig standard. This was originally developed by IBM. And it was a very reliable network architecture based on the token passing access control method. Okay, so remember when you were a little kid and you all sat in a circle at daycare time and you had sharing and everybody shares something about their weekend and you pass the bean bag or whatever little item around and whoever has the bean bag gets to talk and no one else can talk. Well, that's like your token ring topology and protocol. The beanbag gets passed around, and only the host with the beanbag or token gets to talk.
Except unlike in Token Ring, where there is a method of actually stopping this from happening, you weren't allowed to actually club the person over the head in daycare if they held the beanbag for too long. You can do that on
This is an example of an architecture where the physical topology is different than the logical topology because you're not going to have all of your hosts in a circle. It's probably going to be more of a physical star topology. So it looks like a star, but it goes around the token goes around in a circle. And if you want to find out more about the token ring, there's some more in your notes, and you can always use the Wikipedia portion, but really not very widely used anymore.
It's actually still used in transactional systems for things like banks and stuff, which do need those high sorts of bandwidth and high reliability networks. Also, there is a Thursday chat on Token Ring in the 2007 area up on the website if anybody wants to listen to the architectural things of Token Ring. Our fearless leader, Ian Murray, does a talk on Token Ring, its architecture, and its implementation.
Another type of token ring architecture is FDDI. This is a type of token ring network. It is different from the IBM token ring LAN architecture because it is a dual token ring. So you've got two rings, and the primary ring is the only ring used unless it fails, and then you have a secondary backup ring. And it's used, fiber optic cable is used in this kind of configuration. Okay. Just scrolling here, guys. There are several worldwide standards responsible for setting network standards. These are used by manufacturers as a basis for developing technology. If we didn't have standards, everybody would have different types of technologies, and one manufacturer's technology would not work with another manufacturer's technology. Imagine if you had to buy all one type of technology. Imagine that your gateway computer could not talk to your Linksys router because there were no standards. Yeah.
Some people experience that, they buy a Dell.
And I'm just scrolling some more here to see what else we need to cover.
I just thought I'd chime in and say, with standardizing things, I remember the U.S. had quite a huge issue before we had our standard method of our currency. Everyone had their own kind of currency, and it was just a mess.
Okay, we are going to talk a little bit more about the Ethernet protocol. It was, as I said, the standard is created by the IEEE. It is the IEEE 802.3 Ethernet standard. And we have various protocols that we use. That would be Ethernet usually uses the TCP/IP standard of protocols to send signals. But before we get into that, we are going to talk about the difference between CSMA /CD and CSMA /CA, which is used on wireless networks. So you remember from a few minutes ago that in the CSMA /CD, all the stations listen to the network for clearance to talk, and if there is a collision, then they're going to send their data again in a few milliseconds. So you wait to it's similar to waiting to hear the dial tone on the phone and then dialing a number. With the first, with the collision avoidance. Sorry. Okay, it's gone. Can you go over the
collision avoidance? Is used to avoid collisions because on a wireless network you can only transmit or receive at the same time. Therefore, the networks use a method of beaconing, which allows the access point to moderate the communications between the end nodes and the access point, so they actually send a little chirp to see if the other see if the network's ready. The access point then uses what's the term for it? The access point then uses a certain sort of frame, CTS frame, clear to send frame, to tell the station that it's allowed to send. It then delivers its payload onto the wireless network. It's not covered in your tests. Let's move on.
Yep. Okay. We are going to talk about the OSI reference model and the TCP/IP reference model, which is covered in the test. And these are how these are the protocols how
the OSI reference model is a seven-layer model. It was put out by the Open Systems Interconnect group of people. The bottom layer of the OSI reference model is the physical layer. The next layer from that is the data link layer, followed by the network layer, the transport layer, the session layer, the presentation layer, the application layer. Seven-layer model, it was actually came out after the TCP/IP model. TCP/IP model has four layers. It has the network access layer, it has the networking layer, it has the transport layer, it has the session layer. The two models do map to each other, which Grace will cover when she scrolls down to that section of the notes. The TCP/IP layer is in more common use than the OSI reference model because it came out before the OSI reference model. However, the OSI reference model is useful to compare protocols from different vendors and manufacturers. It provides a measuring stick by which you can compare various protocols and their features.
It's also good to use, and this stuff is not really covered in this course, but for people doing the CCNA stuff for troubleshooting.
That is correct. We talk about troubleshooting from using the OSI reference model in Discovery 1 and Discovery 2.
Okay, guys, here we are. Sorry about that. In the OSI reference model, or in the, actually the TCP/IP reference model, when we send a message from our computer, it begins at the top layer of, which is the application layer, and moves down the TCP/IP layers to the bottom layer of, which is the network access layer. The encapsulation process is the header information is added to the message as it moves down each layer, and then it's transmitted. After reaching the destination, the message travels back up through the each layer of the TCP/IP model. Same with the OSI reference model. So, we've got a letter. We write the letter at the application layer. Then we're going to put it in the envelope, write the address on it, put it in the mailbox, which is the physical layer, and it's going to be sent across the network, or which is the postal service. The person goes to their mailbox, picks up the letter, opens the letter, that's encapsulating the letter, and then reads it, which would be the application letter again. So that's how a physical way for you to think about how the de-encapsulation and encapsulation process actually works. Application layer protocols provide network services to user applications. These are things like your web browsers, your email programs, and your MSN Messenger would be an application layer program. Your transport protocols are the end-to-end management of the data. And one of the functions of these protocols is to divide the data into manageable segments, our packets that we were talking about earlier, for easier transport across the network. Imagine if your data came in one long stream. What if you had to download something in one long stream, like a song? That'd be very hard for your network to do, and you couldn't download more than one thing at a time. The internet protocols operate in the third layer from the top, the TCP/IP model, and these protocols are used to provide connectivity between the hosts in the network. The network access protocols are the bottom ones, and these have to do with how the hosts access the physical media. And these have to do with what I was talking about earlier, the CSMA/CD, and also the 10 base T standards are defined in this layer. One of the Internet Protocol, IP, provides source and destination addressing, much like the address, return address on a postal envelope. And in conjunction with routing protocols, IP packets provides forwarding from one network to the other. Other network protocols are ICMP, which we talked about, RIP, and ARP. The OSI model is an industry standard framework that is used to provide network communications into seven layers. Most network vendors today use this framework, and this system it's pretty widely used, and if you're going to go into networking, you basically really have to be very familiar with the system. Each layer is responsible for part of the processing to prepare data for transmission on the network. And the layers are the physical layer, the data link layer, the network layer, the transport layer, the session layer, the presentation layer, and the application layer. So we have a mnemonic for that, and that is, please do not throw sausage pizza away. That's how... What? I was like, oh my god, did I get it wrong? I don't think I did.
So, throw sausage pizza in.
Sausage pizza.
You'll remember in your sleep after you've done enough of this.
Exactly. I was like, oh, I didn't say it wrong, did I?
You didn't. You're all right.
I can cope with that kind of remembrance very well.
Because sausage pizza is good. We don't want to throw it away.
Barbecue chicken's better.
Well, if we're really going for it. I like a seafood pizza myself, but that's just me. Okay, we're going to talk about how a... we're going to talk about how the data is sent. So when you want to send data, let's say you want to send an email, this is the encapsulation process. It starts at the application layer. You write your email. The application layer is responsible for providing network access to applications. The information will go through the top three layers. That's your presentation layer. It's going to decide if it's HTML or MIME or how the other computer is going to see it. And then it's going to go to the session layer, which keeps the session open between computers. At the transport layer, the data is broken down into more manageable segments, and they are called PDUs for transport across the network. A PDU describes data as it moves from one layer of the OSI model to another. The transport layer PDU also contains information such as port numbers, sequence numbers, and acknowledgement numbers, which are used for reliable data transport. At the network layer, each segment from the transport layer becomes a packet, and the packet receives the logical addressing information, layer 3 control information. Now, routers work at layer 3 of the OSI reference model, so they are going to dig down to the layer 3 information and see what the logical address of the network is. At the data link layer, each packet from the network layer becomes a frame. The frame contains the physical address, which is the MAC address. Sorry, there was stuff going on in here. The frame contains a physical address and error correction. So a switch operates at layer 2, the data link layer, and it looks up the MAC address. At the physical layer, the frame becomes bits. That's ones and zeros. And these bits are transmitted one at a time across the network medium. At the receiving computer, the de-encapsulation process reverses, so it goes right back up. The bits are converted back into frames. The MAC address is read. The IP address is read. It's passed up to the transport layer, which puts it all back together. It goes through the presentation layer to see what it is, and then it is passed up to the application layer, and the other person gets your email. Are there any questions on that?
I think I kind of followed that.
As I said, think of it as a letter. You write up... oh, my goodness. Of course. You write the letter. You put it in the envelope. It gets sent through the mail. That's the physical medium. It takes the... you put it in the mailbox, open up the letter, de-encapsulate it, and you read it. And that's pretty much how it works. Does anyone have any questions or anything I can clarify? I know that was kind of a little bit hard to follow, and I got lost on what I was trying to find. So if there are any questions, do feel free to ask. Okay, that brings me to the end of my lecture. Are there any questions on... yeah. On anything? You do have a quiz. Are there any questions on anything I've covered today or anything else?
Anybody
is anyone
awake?
Still awake?
I'm good. I think I'm just going to try and focus on all that other stuff that I have to do.
What
the
I've
eyes are open, but it's dark.
Yes. There's this is in the notes. There's a very good explanation of it in the notes, and they do use the letter example, so you'll feel right at home when you look at them. Yeah. If there are no other questions, we can do the quiz. So if everybody wants to get into their chat windows, that'd be very good. Okay. Let's see, is everybody in their windows? Right. She doesn't need to. She's exempt. Nah. The internet is an example of which type of network? A LAN, a SAN, a WAN, or a WLAN? That would be A, B, C, or D? Answer now. The answer is C. It is the world's biggest WAN, wide area network. Okay, here's another good one. What is the suggested maximum number of PCs in a peer-to-peer network by Microsoft? We went over this last week, so try and remember back. Is it A, 10, B, 25, C, 50, or D, 100? Yep, that's absolutely right. Everybody remembered last week's lecture well. It is a 10. Which methods of data transfer allows information to be sent and received at the same time? Is it A, full duplex, B, half duplex, C, multiplex, or D, simplex? Absolutely. Yep.
Full duplex.
She did. Which dotted decimal number is used to distinguish the network portion of an IP address from the host portion? This was covered last week and also in our supplemental lecture, which I really highly recommend people listen to. Was it A, default gateway, B, MAC address, C, physical address, or D, the subnet mask? And D is absolutely right. It is the subnet mask. Good job. All right. Which cable type is a common choice for use on an Ethernet network? Is it A, thick coax, B, thin coax, C, STP, or D, UTP? Any other answers? And D wins. It is UTP, unshielded twisted pair. And we talked about this also in our last lecture and also in the supplemental lecture. Which networking protocol translates a network name such as www.cisco.com to a unique IP address? Is it A, APIPA, B, ARP, C, DHCP, or D, DNS? And that's right, it is DNS, Dynamic Name Server. And there's a dog.
Domain Name Server.
Domain Name Server. I did. Which protocol maps known IP addresses to MAC addresses on a local network? Is it A, ARP, B, DHCP, C, FTP, or D, RARP? And that's right. It is A. Oh. See, no more than you thought. Okay, so this is a troubleshooting question, which will build on knowledge that we already have. So, a technician wishes to update the NIC driver for a computer. Which would be the best location for finding the new drivers for the NIC? Would it be the installation media that came with the NIC, Windows Update, the website of the manufacturer, or the installation media for Windows? That's right. You all are good troubleshooters. Okay, and that is the end of our quiz. Does anyone else have any questions? I'd really advise you guys to read your notes. Because there's a lot in this chapter. It is a really, really heavy chapter.